Welcome to another exciting episode of the NIDS View, a weekly show of the National Institute for Deterrence Studies, where we are advancing peace, promoting stability, and helping you to think deterrence. Each week, we will discuss and analyze a recent topic and provide insight to how it affects our national deterrence. The view of the hosts and guests are their own. We hope you enjoy the show.
Welcome back to another great episode of the NIDS View, a podcast of the National Institute for Deterrence Studies, where we are always trying to get you to think deterrence and, you know, hug a nuke, all those kind of great things, you know, something we do daily. You know, I think that maybe that's what we need to do is get one for, you know, get one for the office. And then when people come in, you know, they can hug it and take a picture and, you know, that would be great.
Would I need one of those lead vests like at the dental office before I do that?
No. You'd be good. You'd be good. That's one of the things Jim made sure is that you can hug it without issue.
Yeah, and I have pictures of my grandkids. I live in Dayton, Ohio, and the Air Force Museum is really good. And you can get your family wrapped around all these things. So I have all my grandkids and myself wrapped around several nuclear weapon mock-ups in there. And they make for great Christmas gifts. So anyway, just pass that on to everybody.
So, you know, it's been an interesting week. You know, last week we talked about, you know, the 12-day war and the U.S. Strikes on Iran. And so that was an interesting discussion. It was good to have, you know, Dakota, you know, as an attorney. Setting in with us, you know, an attorney who specializes in those kind of defense issues, you know, because you were gone. You were down in Louisiana at the Triad Symposium, Curtis.
Yes, I was. And it was fantastic.
It was good to have you back. Now, this week, there's a new issue of Foreign Affairs that's out. And, you know, Vipin Narang and Pranay Vaddi, who were two officials in the Biden administration, apparently, you know, reality is too much to bear. And so Vipin and Pranay have had a coming to Jesus meeting and they've changed their ways. And I thought about that the title of their article, which is How to Survive the New Nuclear Age, National Security in a World of Proliferating Risks and Eroding Constraints. I thought they should have called it Curtis and Adam were right all along. Let me tell you why. That's what I thought it should have been.
See dynamic parity.
Yeah, I mean, that's really because I think you and I have been saying the same thing, which now they're saying, which I'm glad they're on the bus. They're, you know, we welcome any and all on the bus because we want to get it right. So, you know, the article was a good article. It was well written. You know, they largely state what you and I have been saying about, you know, the state of the world. And, you know, we've been advocating it for quite some time because, you know, that we need new nuclear weapons, that we need a greater variety of nuclear weapons, that we've got to be able to more effectively deter an increasingly aggressive China. You know, it's, and having worked in the nuclear enterprise for decades, we know just how, and Jim, you know this as well as anybody, from the technical side, you just don't produce these things overnight. And so it was good to hear, you know, Vipin and Pranay write a well-written article that says, you know, what the threats are. And they were as hawkish as you and I have been. Mm-hmm. And so it was good to see. And, you know, this kind of goes back to the Strategic Posture Commission, where you had a bipartisan Strategic Posture Commission, you know, that half of them were some of the people that were, you know, former Biden officials who were so anti-nuke early in the Biden administration that they were too anti-nuke for the Biden administration. And yet they signed the Strategic Posture Commission's report. And so it just goes to show that even in the arms control community, learning can happen, you know, so... I love the article. I thought it was great. I know there are some specific things that you wanted to talk about, Curtis. And I know, Jim, you sort of said, hey, I got a little bit different, you know, take on it from my reading. And so, you know, I thought we'd go ahead and cover that. So Jim, I know you had sort of a different take from myself and Curtis. So I wanted you to sort of start us off with your different perspective.
Well, once again, Adam, thanks for following what I thought was our show prep, giving Curtis the opening line. But that's okay. I appreciate you throwing me a curveball again. So my only comment, and I don't know these people, so you know, I've not met either of these authors, although I did look at many of their writings. And as Adam stated, it looks like their views of the world have changed. And I echo the comments that we need to be in a world where people realize that they've gone down a path that leads us to something we don't want to be in. And so now we're in a situation where we've got to think differently and be dynamic. And oh, by the way, that's what we need to have with our government and our military all along. Our adversaries will never, ever remain static, because they will never not really be adversaries then. They're just static because we sort of put them in their place and then move on. And so that is a good thing. And there's many, many good comments here. I have a few that I don't necessarily agree with, but Curtis got so fired up in the show prep that he actually caused his computer to go offline. We had to wait a few minutes to even do this recording. So I'm going to take your curveball, Adam, and slice at it with my bat and whack it over to Curtis, where he can do that. So that's about as good as I get on my baseball references. And then hopefully he'll toss it over to me on first base, and I'll swing my bat there. I guess I don't know much about baseball. Go ahead, Curtis.
Well, first of all, it's good to be back and to see you all. It's clear that my little laptop couldn't handle all the brilliance I was spewing out here, and it shut itself down. So, you know, these things happen. Like you, Adam and Jim, I think this is a fantastic article. The assessment was really well done. The impact is what should be expected. The recommendations leave some things to be desired. But I want to start off to our listeners here. I think to start this discussion is the statement here towards the end where they say to maintain a credible strategy for this new nuclear age, the United States must begin by recognizing and understanding the world as it is, not as many hoped or wished it would be. Now, I would include the Biden administration as those who were wishing what it could have been. And so I want to point out that to your point, Adam, that that Vipin and Pranay, I think had a, you know, the pressures when you are in power, the pressure and responsibility of being in power, and I guess the access to real world information and intelligence can really force you into what us rednecks would call an attitude adjustment. I would say for this is a perception adjustment as to what the world is and how we're going to get there. Now, there's still what I think is an unrealistic hope for arms control as a means to solve this problem in this paper, which I think is grasping at straws, at least for the time being. But I wanted to start off with that. There are a lot of great things about this piece, and I'm going to highly recommend that my students, as well as our viewers and listeners, take a moment and read through this. It's about 14 pages when you print it out, but it is a good read.
You know, Curtis, you and I could become two of the biggest advocates of arms control in the near future, because arms control, if you really think about arms control, who does it benefit most? It benefits the weak. Sure. And historically, when we've signed arms control agreements, we've been strong. And we have been willing to create parity with the weak, you know, whether the Soviet Union or whomever, you know, we've been willing to create parity between us strong, them weak. And that's really, you know, what we've done. But now you know, that role will be reversed here very soon and will be the weak one. And the problem that I see is that the strong, i.e. the Russians and the Chinese, are not going to take the same attitude. They will not be benevolent as the United States has been. Because for them, particularly the Russians, because the Russians are never going to have conventional parity with the United States. And so the Russians have to maintain nuclear superiority in order to compensate for conventional inferiority. So I think it could be that arms control with China is a better prospect than future arms control with Russia, because for the Russians, you know, they're sort of in a new look policy era where they're using nuclear forces sort of the way that we did when we knew our conventional forces were inferior in the 1950s. They're now in that role. Mm-hmm. And so, and we're going to be the ones with the inferior nuclear forces, and we'll be the ones who want arms control because we want to push them down to parity with us. And then the real question is going to be, will the Chinese do anything? Will they ever participate? But, you know, you and I have long been opponents of arms control, or skeptical. Maybe we're not opponents, we're skeptics.
Mm-hmm.
Because, you know, I think the main thing arms control is good for is that you get to better understand your adversary and what they fear and what they want. That's kind of what it's, but you could learn that through other means than arms control.
Mm-hmm.
But generally, I don't favor it. But I may become a big fan of it here pretty soon if we're the weaker, we're the weakest of the, you know, the nuclear powers.
Well, you know, not to get into a debate on arms control for this particular topic, but I would say that arms control, when we look back, the history of its success is sort of shaded by all of its failure. And I mean that in a sense of there's not a treaty that the Russians didn't cheat on. And then our notable tolerance of that for such a long time, even before we left the treaties, I think demeans the whole process. And while I've heard the argument that, well, it's the act of negotiating that allows us to understand each other, what it really came down to is Russians who got tired of listening to Americans lecture to them what deterrence is and how it works when it didn't meet their needs. But the one thing, as I've said in the past, that they both agree on, whether you are an American negotiator or a Russian-Soviet negotiator, was that both of your goals were to either weaken or disarm the United States as much as possible, especially when it came to nuclear weapons. And so for that matter, you know, I think we have achieved that. And the point of this article, as interesting as it is a reconciliation of the past to say that we have ignored this problem for so long that it is become a time sink and a cost sink to try to catch up. We just cannot do it. And we must now endure a more tenuous deterrence on legacy weapons being extended well beyond their shelf life, as the modernization effort that has been delayed and its cost burdens have increased continues to limp along in a strategy designed for a world that was 15 years ago. And even as these two individuals, as great thinkers as they are, were in positions of power, Adam, and they chose to do nothing to fix this problem in their 4 years in control, at the levers of control. And don't tell me B-61-13 was the way to go. That was a net zero change. It was not any additional B-61s. And it was meant to create, and we had a podcast on this when it was first announced, its purpose was to justify the retirement of the B-83. That's it. So these two individuals have participated in this downfall. And I appreciate their cathartic moment here on these 14 pages of sharing with us about, gee, just how, you know, how the world really is. But there's no reflection on the past 4 years of where we were and how we didn't move that football.
Yeah.
And that's my frustration with this piece.
Yeah. There's no sort of, hey, you know, here was our chances and here's how we missed them.
Yeah. So we're 4 years behind even more now. And while, like I said, it's great that you realize it now that you're not under the yoke of the administration, but that doesn't help us now. All right. We're now 4 years behind. They could have improved, sped things up, made changes, done things more than just continue to admire the problem, which is all they did in the 4 years that they did. Again, great paper. They said all the right things, but they're no longer in power.
Yeah. So, I mean, think about what could have been done when Lloyd Austin was having surgeries and President, you know, Biden was in memory care. Who was watching the store? They could have gotten a lot of good things done during that time.
That's right. I mean, we could have auto-penned a Slickum, right?
We could have.
So
that's a good point. Well, that's a good point.
The piece, though, that stands out here, and one of the leadership lessons I've always learned, is it's easier to, when you're not held responsible, to come out and say what you really mean.
That's exactly right.
And that's what you see here is when someone's placed in a position of leadership, they're held responsible. These people waited until the end of that, until, you know, at least what you're telling me here. And after they're no longer responsible, now you come out and say, well, you know, this might have been a good thing, but that's just
one observation. Well, and not only, to add to that, Jim, they were held accountable, right, to their boss, the president, whose position was quite clear. And I will remind our viewers and listeners that President Biden's national security statement stated on page 21, we will remain equally committed to reducing the risk of nuclear war, and this includes taking further steps to reduce the role of nuclear weapons in our strategy and pursuing realistic goals for mutual verifiable arms control, which contribute to our deterrence strategy and strengthen the global nonproliferation regime. None of that is true.
Yeah.
But that was the goal of an idealistic administration that sought to create an environment where our adversaries would follow us down the disarmament path, and I just don't see them disarming. Do you?
No, and the other piece of this, though, and I'm going to poke at something that I find in not only this writing, I looked at some of the other writings, and I looked at some of the recent discussions about the Chinese nuclear ambitions as well. And I think we're pointing at some of the wrong things. And let me lay this out quickly. We continue to look at it and say, well, China now has approximately 300 or so nuclear weapons declared, at least according to this article. They're going to quadruple the number in the next decade. So, you know, that there's going to be so many more nuclear weapons, and that's the problem. But let me remind everybody, in around 1965, the United States had 30,000 nuclear weapons. We never went to war. And, you know, in the mid-80s, Russia was roughly, about 35,000 declared strategic nuclear weapons. And now we have no idea how many tactical weapons there are. My point is, the number of nuclear weapons is not the new part of the equation. The part of the new equation is that you have two adversaries, nuclear adversaries, that have distributed the method and their ambitions using nuclear weapons as the kingpin for what they're doing and leverage. You have Russia with both their tactical nuclear force and their strategic nuclear force and their ambitions, you know, their revanchist concept of, you know, rebuilding. And you have China with the same concept, but a completely different strategy. So I would argue that it's not about the number of nuclear weapons that are out there, but it's the number of people that have credible strategic nuclear forces to be able to counter that. And I'm going to be extremely hawkish here, and I've done that before on this podcast, that once again, it might be valuable instead to say, if the problem is not the number of nuclear weapons, but the number of countries that have strategic interests with a strategic nuclear force to counter our adversaries, we may be able to provide a deterrent that's going to stop this increase in their weapons. They see no end to that. And I'm talking about what I've said before, South Korea, Japan, possibly, I've said Australia, and people go, oh, Australia will never have nuclear weapons. Well, they would if it was in their interest.
That's right.
And even India gone beyond tactical nuclear weapons, but strategic nuclear weapons, you know, and I think they all have that capability. So it's not just the number on the shelf, because China can build a decade more, you know, an order of magnitude of 10 more nuclear weapons. And we're not even close to where we were in 1980 of the number of nuclear weapons on Earth right now. And I want to hear this malarkey of, oh, we're going to blow up the Earth thousands of times over. Adam, I owe you that paper. And that's got to come out on GSR because I've done all the math. You're not going to blow up the Earth, you know, 10 times over, or whatever the crazy statements that are made. The reality is that you have to have the one thing that deters nuclear weapons is nuclear weapons. That's the reality. Because the, how's Curtis say it? The squeeze, the juice cannot be worth the squeeze. And so you take away the juice and there'll be no more squeeze. And that's what we need to be able to do with our nuclear weapons. And I don't see that in this article. In fact, most of what happened, I highlighted something. That's why when Adam passed this on, he was looking for this comment I made because I highlighted it, but my computer erased it for some odd reason. I should have written it down. But almost everything is the United States has to do this. The United States has to do it. And I agree, the United States has to do this. But one of the things we do have to do is we have to begin working with our allies who have as much of a strategic interest in putting away this strong-arming, bullying, whatever you want to call it, from China and Russia, in order to stop this change in the world order that they also would benefit from controlling or lose if it suddenly gets out of hand. And if that means more numbers, I'm okay with that. At one time, as I said, 40,000 nuclear weapons, we're not close to that. Let's end it sooner with us on the winning side so that Adam doesn't have to become a treaty verification expert, because that's where you're heading, right, Adam?
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. I want to be the guy that gets to host the arms control meetings. That's sort of like event planning, but, you know, that kind of thing. I'm kind of passionate about it.
Yeah.
But you know, if we could really just have a strategy of hope and change.
No.
I mean, I really think
we had that.
That's Oh, we did. We did. Oh, hope and change didn't work?
I disagree. No, hope and change. I hope that we begin to see the world realistically, and the change is we stop talking about these silly things that end up giving our adversaries the ability to get the upper hand. Because we're Americans. We've done it before. We can do it again. So I'm all about that hope and change, not the hope and change you're talking about.
So, you know, I get this a lot. Hope and change, yeah, that doesn't work. What you need is faith and works. And the idea here is that you've got to have the works, and then you got to have faith in the works, right? And the faith is that if I do this, I do this, and I do this, I will get this result. And that's really how we have to look at deterrence in that regard. You were talking about the numbers, Jim, and I wanted to point out in this piece that the authors say here that. They said, to be clear, there is no need for the United States to deploy more nuclear forces than those of China and Russia combined. Now, we put out a strategy about a year ago, right? July of 2024, called Dynamic Parity, that basically says that we must match. We don't currently do that. We must match our adversaries as a collective. Because these authors do note also, by the way, that the Biden administration in 2024 updated the nuclear weapons employment planning guidance to include, quote, to be able to deter China, North Korea, and Russia simultaneously. So they took in the Strategic Posture Commission's conclusions and said, yes, we have to deter all three at the same time. Whether you want to count those three as one, or whether you want to count those three as three individuals, but they're additive, the answer is still the same. And they note that you shouldn't seek superiority, which I'm sure there are strategists out there who would argue that. They said that you do not need. But then they said, but you don't need to be identical in size and composition. Well, you know, again, you know, you can quibble about the numbers on the fringes, but you can't be orders of magnitude less.
No.
Which is what we are or will be if we don't change the strategy trajectory that we're on now. Because we're at the point now where it will be, whereas we have 1,550, Russia will have 1,550, assuming they don't build up. China will have 1,500, and then and the Koreans, the North Koreans, will probably have 300, of which a percentage of that will be strategic set. So assume 10, 20, 30% of those. So you're talking real, those are all targets that have to be covered if you're going to sufficiently deter. So I think as you get to the recommendations part of this, I think then they start to fall apart where they try to have it both ways. It's difficult to match numbers and then say, oh, but we shouldn't have more, although they advocate for more submarines in their recommendation.
Yeah, you know, it was an interesting one because, I mean, I'm just grateful that they read dynamic parity. They may have disagreed, which people could disagree. That's
a great article, by the way, guys.
Yes, yes.
But, I mean, the one thing that I don't think people understand is human psychology.
Yes.
And we made this point, and the point is that people understand and value symmetry.
Yes.
And they value symmetry in many ways. And, you know, it's scientific. I mean, beautiful people by human standards are people whose the left and right side of their face is symmetrical. People have a tendency to be drawn to people who are similar to them based on size, race, you know, how they talk, what you know, what their accent is. So people are always looking for symmetry. It's just a natural trait. And that trait doesn't stop when it comes to building nuclear weapons. And adversaries feel comfortable and understand symmetry. That's why exotic weapons are actually probably your most challenging component in a, you know, in a nuclear arsenal. FOBs and, torpedoes that are megaton torpedoes that'll send irradiated tsunamis over ports. Those kinds of exotic weapons can be the things that are not supportive of stability. But having sort of symmetry and capability in numbers, that's actually pretty stabilizing because they say, oh, you know, I understand that. I understand 1,000 ICBMs and I understand a bomber force. And I understand, but when you have like floating rods from God and you have all these other things, this is why, you know, a multi-domain deterrence is a hard thing, right? I mean, we've never had a cyber war or a space war. How is that going to go? That is sort of, that creates a lot of asymmetry and that creates a lot of uncertainty and doubt, which, I mean, I think for both of them, both, you know, Pranay and Vipin, that's what they're opposed to. And so I think they're making a mistake in dismissing the importance of similar numbers and similar capabilities.
Yeah. Well, I don't think you should or could conflate, you know, weapons of terror, like the torpedo and things that you just discussed, the irradiated tsunamis. Those are terror weapons that are designed to be destabilizing, with more stabilizing capabilities, as we've discussed. And I put out a piece this past March also talking about balancing. It was Trump's trade and tariff policy benefits America's nuclear deterrent. And it sort of benefits this, posits this idea that if, you know, fair trade makes sense to a lot of people, so should a balanced deterrent. It's fair. Right. And I mean, this is the complaint of the Chinese, is that it's not fair to us because you have so many more than we do. What they have a hard time understanding is that if you build up, you're going to force us to have to build up, too. And that's where the arms race sort of comes into effect. And so, you know, and this is getting worse, too. Before this, our time runs out, I want to point out that this article, I don't want to say if we could say it made some news, but I'll tell you, this article came out. There was a lot of references to this article as a news source because the authors note in here that
as I'm reading from the piece here in Foreign Affairs, U.S. intelligence agencies have concluded that the Pakistani military is developing an ICBM that could reach the continental United States. In acquiring such a capability, Pakistan may be seeking to deter the United States from either trying to eliminate its arsenal in a preventive attack. Oh, when did that just happen? Mm-hmm. Or intervening on India's behalf in a future India-Pakistani conflict. And this really came out in a sort of a lesser advertised presentation by on December 21st at the 2024, the Carnegie Endowment. Is it Carnegie Endowment for Peace? Is that what that is? By then the deputy national security advisor, John, I think it's Finer or Finner, he gave a speech where he talked about, hey, we've discovered that they're building some really large rocket motors and we're going to put some sanctions on them for doing that. So, the risk of our, I don't want to call Pakistan an adversary. They're not an adversary, but there is a risk out there of others who have an interest in ensuring that America cannot flex its muscle, its military influence in their regions, and they feel the need to be able to threaten the homeland directly, right? Ma and Pa in Sacramento as a way to keep us out of their interests. And so we're going to have to figure out a way to do that. And continuing a minimalist arsenal that we have had over the last 30 plus years is not going to help us in that way anymore. And so to their credit, these authors have realized this and are publicly stating it, but are still stopping short of calling for what I think, you know, really needs to happen in order to get there. There's still this desire, well, let's negotiate our way out of this. You cannot negotiate another state's national interest. If they're hell-bent on achieving them, they're going to do that. That conflict occurs, Jim, when nation states, when their interests collide, right? Mm-hmm. And so this is the thing. You've got to prepare for the inevitable collision, and that means you've got to have the arsenal you need tomorrow, not the one you had yesterday.
Yeah. Now, as we wrap up the show, because we're out of time, Jim was, you know, I'll say the one other thing that I liked that, because I've long been saying, hey, in this new environment, part of the reason we need dynamic parity, we need, you know, the same number of weapons and systems is because the Chinese and the Russians might work together.
That's right.
And that's one of the things they broached is that we cannot... You know, they call it synchronized aggression.
Yes.
Yep.
And the idea that people say, oh, that would never happen. The Russians and the Chinese would never do that. And I have to sit and think, well, why would you say that? Because autocracies consistently work together. And the Chinese are working with the Russians and they've worked with the Iranians and in Ukraine, in Europe. They're supporting the fight in Europe right now.
Right. Right. And North Korea.
And North Korea. So why would that be what they're willing to do? But there's no other circumstances under which they would do it.
Right.
And it seems odd to me. But I'm, you know, good on them for saying that we have to think about this and that this has to be a consideration. Jim, did you have any final sort of parting thoughts?
No, I'll read a line. I found the line that I wanted to read from this Foreign Affairs article. I think it's important. In addition to reaffirming extended deterrence, the United States should seek to revive arms control and nuclear risk reduction efforts, even if today's environment has made such measures far more difficult. By adjusting its own nuclear posture, the United States could motivate China and Russia to come to the table. And again, if you don't read the rest of that paragraph, and I'm going to let the listeners listen to the rest of that, you could take that two different ways. One, you could argue, oh, so if we do it, you know, we reduce ours or we reduce hers. But actually, this is not one of those times in this article, which I was refreshed to see. Because you look further, it says, yeah, we need to allow higher number of warheads Bring people to the table. Make them negotiate so that we can bring things back to order. Because I don't think things are in order. And I think the further we go without doing something, the further out of order they become. And once they get far enough out of order, then conflict becomes possible, very possible. And I'd like to stay away from that. We're a peace organization. I'd like to see us remain at peace. But I think nuclear weapons are a main, primary, if not the strategy that helps to maintain this. So back to you, Adam.
I mean, as America's favorite Secretary of Defense once said, you know, I'm talking about Donald Rumsfeld.
Oh, that one.
Peace, he said, peace or weakness is provocative. Ranking. Weakness is provocative.
A lot of people have said that.
But Don Rumsfeld is famous for it. So, you know.
He is.
I mean,
so let me just add one thing as we're parting thoughts here, and I want to just build on Jim's idea here. Treaties only work when the nations who are participating in it want to be there and feel that it is in their national interest to be in that treaty.
Yep.
And it only works because of the rules-based international order. But when your adversaries don't want to be in the treaty because they don't want to be constrained and they don't like the rules-based international order as it is currently defined, there is no way in heck you're going to get them to a treaty to negotiate. The only out of the goodness of their hearts or their politics or even their economic well-being, they have to be scared enough. You've got to induce enough fear that they say the only way is if we've got to come to the table and in good faith figure out a way to solve this problem. And they're just not afraid of us. And that's why they're not motivated to negotiate.
That's why the only good arms control treaty the U.S. has ever signed has been INF.
INF.
Because we gave up very little and they gave up a lot. Otherwise, they've all sucked, and we're a bad idea.
That's right. That's right.
Okay. All right. Well, it was a great article. Good job. Yep.
Good job, guys.
Dippin. Good job, Pranay.
Pranay.
It was a great article. Says a lot. You know, welcome to Team America. I mean, can I say?
That's right. We'd like to maybe extend an offer, a fellowship for the National Institute for Deterrent Studies to Pranay and Vipin. They've got a home here.
Or at least come on a podcast and have a discussion with us.
Geez, you know, it's part nuclear discussion, part comedy show. I mean,
absolutely.
What is funnier than a discussion about nuclear weapons? I don't know what topic is.
The humor never gets any darker.
All right. Well, of course, we're out of time. So we want to, you know, thanks to you, the listeners. Thanks, Jim. Thanks, Curtis. You know, there's a lot of good articles coming up on Global Security Review. So make sure you're reading. And I just talked to, you know, we have some relationships with, you know, Pakistan's leading think tank, and they write, you know, periodically for Global Security Review. And so I reached out to them and I said, hey, one of you guys write an article about this idea that Pakistan is building an ICBM for this purpose? And they said, that is not true. That is a misrepresentation of what we're doing. And they said, yes, we will write an article. So that article will be coming in the coming weeks.
Oh, I can't wait to read that one.
So stand by for that. There's a lot of good stuff coming up. Some good articles, some interesting topics. You know, podcasting is out there. There's Deterrence Down Under. There's going to be some great episodes in the future. We're going to, I think, one of our Australian NIDS members is going to start doing some interviews for Global Security Review. And so we'll have sort of a new segment for that. That'll be interesting.
That's great.
That's Natalie's going to be our, you know, global
reporter at large.
Yeah. Our global roving reporter. And she'll be talking with leading thinkers. You know, there's, you know, your X, you know, you spend a lot of time really, you know, on X to find good articles, and then you've got some good comments. So check that out. You know, Jim is, you know, he's in his barn And I know it glows at night, but I'm not quite sure what he's doing out there. But I know he's building
something. I'm just welding.
Welding. I thought it was a time machine for a while, but, you know.
I told you that yesterday. Oh, never mind. Or was it tomorrow? You know. I can't remember.
Exactly. Yeah. It doesn't really matter. You can go either way. So there's a lot of stuff going on at NIDS. There's a lot of stuff going on at NIDS. So, you know, stay engaged. Send us your comments or thoughts. Send us, you know, if you want a podcast on a given topic, say, hey, guys, we want you to talk about a given topic. We've done that. We'll be happy to do it again.
Or questions from the audience. Those are awesome, too.
Yeah. Yeah. So at any rate, you know, great show. Of course, thanks to you, the audience. And as always, we want to remind you to think deterrence.
Thank you for listening to the NIDS View. This show is produced under the NIDS Podcasting Network, a division of the National Institute for Deterrence Studies. NIDS is a 501c3 organization dependent upon donations to provide this podcast and bring about awareness of the peacekeeping value of U.S. strength and our national deterrence. You can catch all of our podcasts or provide feedback at thinkdeterrence.com. I would like to thank our producer, Kimberly Charrington, our sponsors, and all the fantastic members of the National Institute for Deterrence Studies for making this podcast possible. Stay tuned next week for another exciting and informative The NIDS View.
The NIDS Podcasting Network.